This episode of Knife Talk is sponsored by Tormek. For your chance to win a T4 sharpening system, visit knifetalk.net to enter the draw. The winner will be chosen on our 10th show and will receive a Tormek T4 and a set of jigs to make your knives razor sharp. Welcome to episode 3 of Knife Talk. Wow, episode 3 already. Today I'll be speaking with Jeff Fader of Fader Knives. And like me, Jeff mainly makes knives for the kitchen. So I'm keen to learn more about his processes. So hey, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Craig, this is a real pleasure.
Good to hear.
Now, I can't even believe it that I'm on number 3. I listened to the podcast number 1 with Walter Sorrells. Incredible. I listened to Alex Steele number 2. Incredible. And now here's the drop-off of Knife Talk. Precipitous drop-off.
You've had some great warm-up acts. This is your moment.
Oh, yeah, you're killing me, but that's fine. I'm with you. This is unbelievable.
So let's try and set the scene. I tried to do this at the beginning of each episode. So are you in your workshop at the moment?
No, I'm not. I'm in the house.
Okay.
I'm in a quiet room.
Is your workshop at home?
I have two workshops. I have a workshop at home, and I'm building a new shop about a mile and a half from my home.
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. So is there much of a knife-making community where you live?
Well, here in the United States, I'm in New York State, which is I'm about an hour north of New York City and where I grew up. And there's a lot of blacksmiths, and there are a number of knife makers in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
The blacksmithing and the blade community have been really growing, and a lot of it is people be able to see it through Instagram and social media and stuff like that. But there are a number of really high level guys in the Northeast of the United States.
Yeah, yeah. And why do you think that is? Why do you think it's growing at such a rate? I've discussed this before on previous episodes, and everybody seems to come up with this with a similar sort of theme. And I'm just wondering, curious about your opinions on that.
Well, it's interesting. Be honest with you, I started out as a sculptor. I was a steel sculptor, metal worker, and then I ended up working for a blacksmith shop. It's called now Fine Architectural Metalsmiths, which is connected to Center for Metal Arts, which is one of the best blacksmith learning schools in the Northeast.
Right.
And when I was there 10, 15 years ago, there was really social media really hadn't kicked in yet. And I was working under a lot of blacksmiths by the name of Uri Hoffey and Fred Christ and John Ledford. And these were guys who were, they were incredible wealth of information, but you were seeing blacksmiths that were just there. You weren't seeing a lot of new guys. It seemed like it was a dying business. And one of the things was with blacksmithing, especially, there's an organization called ABANA in the United States. And at the time, when I joined 15 years ago, there was only 3,000 members, 3,000 plus members. And with the rise of social media and people seeing what's going on with blacksmiths and now bladesmiths and with the show Forged in Fire, you're getting a real, you're seeing a lot more tool makers, hammer makers, and craftsmen, especially in the United States. And it's incredible. It's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, from my point of view, I think, I've been making things all my life, but the last sort of 15 years, they've been digital things. And,
right.
they're not tangible. They don't last. You know, my portfolio is gone within 6 months. But I love sort of the whole thing of getting something in your hand, making it and feeling it, and making something that you can use daily as well, you know? And I think maybe more and more people are feeling that way, maybe.
I think there's something to that. I mean, for me, I was an art major, and when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to have certain toys that I wanted. My father showed me how to use bandsaws and tools and stuff like that. So I was making a lot of my own toys at a young age, and swords and bows and arrows and all that stuff.
And the dangerous fun stuff.
For sure. But yeah. In the beginning, I had certain things that I wanted to make. But then what happened was it wasn't really about the thing that I was going to make, but it was the journey of making something new.
Yes.
And when I became a sculptor and I went to art school, it was about creating something and then presenting it. And then I was a chef, I was a cook, and, it was the same thing. You're taking raw ingredients and you're using proper techniques and you're giving it to someone you care about, whether it's making a knife or making food or making sculpture. The buzz that you get from creating something is palpable. And I used to say, when I used to make sculpture, I make these giant fishing lures out of wood and steel and stuff like that. I used to say to people that when you're a sculptor or you're a maker, it doesn't really matter. You could be on a deserted island with no hope of rescue, and you'd still be compelled to make what you want to make. And that's, it's a compulsion. It has to be a compulsion.
Yes. Yeah. And I suppose with a background as a chef and a blacksmith, making blades, it's inevitable, isn't it?
Close to the chef. I got a little bit too gun. I shot from the hip with the chef thing. I went to culinary school, but I was never a chef. I was a cook for a long time, and I work with a lot of chefs, which is a lot of fun. My partner's a chef. But I got a little bit ahead of myself, Craig. I apologize.
So when did it become a job for you? When did you think, this is going to pay the bills? This is going to, this is going to keep my family happy. This is going to be what I need to be doing.
Well, we're still in the make the family happy stage. I was a sculptor for a long time, 20 years, and I had galleries and I was working on stuff. And basically what happened was I was helping at this, a friend of mine, John Ledford, started a school called the Hudson Valley Ironworks. And we were bringing a lot of knife makers like Matt Paul of MP Knives and Darren Fisher, who's an incredible blacksmith. And we would have blacksmiths and jewelers. And I was teaching sculpture classes. And I started helping with Matt Paul, who does incredible bushcraft knives. And I had a history of forging knives and forging, ornamental ironwork. And yeah. I was a busy blacksmith for quite a while. And I just started fooling around. When you're forging knives, when you're forging anything, you can always usually have a couple things in the oven. Or in the forge, I should say. And it was easy for me while I was working on some railings to have a couple knives to fool around and kind of work out, the proper way, the best way for me to do knives. And then all of a sudden I started getting commissions, and I kept it very quiet with my wife because I didn't want her to think I was crazy. And I started making more, hunting style knives, and then forging, do like brute to forge style knives.
Yeah.
And then I started getting commissions, and then it came to the point where I was getting so many commissions that it was hard for me to just not go to the next step. And I approached my good friend Tony Ayazi, who used to be the executive chef at Oriole and now owns this great computer company, a tech company called Shoebox. And I needed help, and he stepped in and became my partner. And we're still at the growing stage in terms of, we have a payroll company, and we're paying each other, and we're paying rent on places and paying lawyers and paying all this stuff. But we're not, knives aren't sending me to the beach.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? We're still in the growing stages, but it's been really great.
Yeah. And it's that thing, isn't it? How will that scale, Hand making a beautiful knife, how do you scale that?
Well, right at this point now, I'm doing everything. And I've always really felt like, I feel like I'm still young as a knife maker for sure. And that's the best part. The best part is, meeting and talking to other knife makers. I'm really excited. I'm going to the Blade Show in Atlanta in a couple months, and I'm meeting really, really amazing bladesmiths. And I'm really, the idea that I'm going to be growing as a, I'm on a journey. I'm on my own journey and the level that I'm at, and I'm looking forward to getting better and better and better. And every knife you make, you pick something new up and you make it better. And it's just, it's an incredible journey. And I just, a real quick story, really, this is a good story. Yesterday I went to this place, this famous restaurant supply store for chefs. It's called JB Prince. And I was there with my partner, and we were there with a couple other people, and we were looking, and we saw they have incredible knives from all over the place. But a lot of them are, company made knives, Hank's Willings and all that.
Yeah.
And then there was this one knife there from Mariko Momasi. I hope I'm saying his name right. Momasi Fire Arts. And it was sitting on this wooden block in the case, and it was just stunning to the point where I started to get blue. I started to get a little bit blue because just like, this guy is just top of the line. It was an integral chef's knife, which an integral chef's knife is where the bolsters part of the blades forged through and the bolsters kind of forged into the blade. And I was reading this little note, and it was this clean knife. It had curly koa, and everything was slick, and it looked like just a beautiful steel knife, and everything like that. Nothing special. I saw a little hamon in it. It was just, you know, beautiful. And then there was this note on it, and the note said, well, this is Mariko's knife, blah, blah, blah. He's giving me all the details. And then it says, this is a Damascus knife. And then all of a sudden I read a Damascus knife, and I'm looking at the knife, and it's shiny. It's got, you know, the hand buffed. It doesn't look like I see like a carbon steel knife with a hamon.
Yeah.
And then I keep reading, and all of a sudden I have this, I can't believe it. What he did was he made it so clean, and he didn't etch it. He didn't etch the blade.
Right. Yeah.
So his idea was that when you work it, you know, when the natural use of this knife will reveal the Damascus.
Ah, right.
So like,
yeah.
So it's like, instead of the whole idea of a lot of people get bummed out when they have a carbon steel chef's knife, and they're bummed out when it starts to patina. He's changed the whole idea. Well, he might not be. I've never seen it before. And so when you're using a knife during daily use, it just, you slowly reveal the Damascus. And I'm just like, God, this is incredible and fantastic. And I'm telling my partner, and I'm looking at it, and I'm showing him. I'm saying, you see that? And this is what's going to happen. And then next to me, there's this guy, this cook who's been overhearing us. And he just kind of gets closer to me, and he goes, hey, you like that knife? And I said, yeah, it's incredible. And I'm just like losing my mind over this knife. And he goes, I got something better for you. You got to go down to, and then he named another store, and he says, you got to go down there, man, because there's a knife with a white handle. And he gets closer as he's speaking quietly. He's looking over his shoulder. He says, this knife is unbelievable. It's so nice. You're going to see it, and you're going to get an erection. And I immediately thought, it just like completely shut the whole conversation. It was really funny, because what he was basically saying was he had no real concept of, you know, that level of knife, but he was just trying to involve himself. And it was this very odd New York moment, but it was amazing because I was looking at the incredible craftsmanship of, you know, this incredible knife from Mariko. And then this guy was like trying to sell me on a white handled Zwilling, something like that. It was pretty funny.
But that's a really interesting concept of that, of Damascus unetched and letting it reveal its beauty over time.
Never seen it before.
It would make you want to use the item more, which is brilliant.
Well, I mean, that was the whole thing. I mean, you're totally reversing the idea of like, how do I keep it so it doesn't do that? And then it's almost like you want to work it harder to force the etch by cooking. And it was just like fascinating, but it was like, it made me blue in the beginning, because it was just like, God damn, my knives will never be this nice. And then all of a sudden at the end, I was like, I'm looking forward to making, you know, the more I make, the better I get. And seeing this is going to inspire me to work harder for the next one.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk a bit about process.
Sure.
So of all the many processes involved in making a great knife, you know, steel selection, the forging, the profiling, grinding, all the rest of it. What's your favorite and what's your least part of making a knife?
That is an awesome question. because I started out doing a lot of forged knives, and now I'm starting to get back into doing more forged knives, and with the new shop and I'm having a power hammer built, I plan on doing more Damascus, and I did some Damascus with Aaron Wilburn of Wilburn Forge. The part I love the best is, I would say, I don't know. You know, I like talking to my customers, because the way my business is a little bit different than a lot of guys is, we have a conversation, and I really try to make customized knives for the particular customer. So
yeah, yeah.
We do a consultation, and then I'll really kind of go with what you want to do. And I really enjoy meeting the customer and talking to the customer before I even made anything. I also do a lot of watercolors beforehand, so I can get some colors, you know, squared away. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy that. I'm not crazy about the hand sanding, because, you know, and I'm not crazy about dealing with plunge lines. But other than that, I love working with the customer. That's my favorite part, is having a relationship with the customer and trying to make them something that they've envisioned, something that they want, and something that I could provide. And I like heat treating too. I like heat treating. That's the scary part for me, you know. If you're doing a stainless steel and you're putting in between two pieces of aluminum with some compressed air and hoping it's flat, or you know, you're bringing your knife up to 1500 and hoping that when you dunk it into your oil, it doesn't warp. You know, there's a little bit of nervousness there that's it's always very exciting.
Yes, yeah. And do you generally use one kind of steel, like 1095, D2, or stainless? Or do you just, whatever the job needs, you'll use whatever you think is best for that job?
When I started, I used a lot. When I was forging knives, I started with a lot of 1095. Yep. And it just became very easy for me to get a hold of. And then in the people, my customer, a lot of my customers wanted stainless steel. So I was getting 440C stainless steel, and I fooled around a little bit with some other stainless steels. But you know, And then, you know, with Damascus, obviously you're getting, you know, into that 15N.
Yeah. Okay. So, like most creatives, you probably got many other creative outlets out there. And I know sort of offline, you've told me about a few of those, but what do you get up to when you're not making knives?
Well, I was formerly trained as a sculptor, and I do a lot of wood carving. I do these, when I was in college, I started doing all these giant fishing lures. So I do these giant fishing lure sculptures. And it's, you know, totally different mechanics, but it's the same outline in terms of, like, you have an idea and then you kind of cut it out and then carve. You have your plan and then you kind of execute. So yeah. I do a lot of these giant lure sculptures, and that's something that I've always loved to do. And, you know, I feel like it's gotten me ready to make knives, you know. And it's also map groups. My last project was I did a installation of 60 needlefish lures. And I had a friend who was a bronze caster, and he was knocking out a lot of casts of bronze sculptures. And then what he would do was he was telling me that you just have to recast them. And I, just to give it to him, I decided that I was going to carve and paint 60 identical fishing lure sculptures. So it was total madness. It drove me crazy. It was just really difficult, but it allowed me, you know, the mindset to actually do knives in batches. So like now I do these chef signature series knives where I collaborate with a chef, and then we'll design something. And then what we'll do is we'll sell a set of 12 limited series, and then I'll make all 12 at the same time. So actually doing the sculptures, the 60 needlefish, allowed me it gave me like the blueprint for making sculptures in making knives in batches, which was a huge help.
Yeah. Okay. And I've been looking at them today actually on Instagram, and they look fantastic.
Really, yeah, cool. They're fun. Cool. I actually started doing those because I had a studio in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, back in after I graduated college, and it was a welding shop, and it was a very dark and, you know, gray, and then I started doing these little painted wooden sculptures to kind of brighten the place up a little bit. So actually that color kind of fits into, I really like for the handles of my chef knives, especially, I really like high contrast colors.
Yes.
So I've been doing with a lot of high contrast colors, which have, you know, harkens back to the days of being an artist, I think.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the great thing. You can express yourself and be creative while making these one-off knives, which is fantastic. So what's on your bench today? What's your current project?
Well, it's funny that you say that because I actually just got back from I ran up to Boston, outside of Boston, Gloucester, to pick up a sculpture for a restaurant. So I've been in the car for 8 hours. And right now what I'm working on is I'm working on this set of 12 knives I did with Chef Charlie Palmer, kind of getting those ready to I finished grinding the bevels in, and finished hand sand, you know, rough hand sanding just to get squared away. And then I'm going to drill them and do the file work for them. And then in the meantime, I got to start another 10 that are kind of, you know, I haven't really gotten to yet, but I'm looking forward to that. So tomorrow it's all knives tomorrow. All knives tomorrow, all day. Yeah. I the sculpture thing is kind of, I was kind of buttoning up some loose ends. So, but I like to do that too.
Yes. Yeah. It's always good. Always good to mix it up a bit. Always good.
Well, tell me about your. Now I'm going to interview the interviewer, because Craig, I heard your first two podcasts. I really enjoyed hearing about Walter and Alec. But I want to know about Craig Lockwood.
Okay.
I want to tell you more about. I want to know about what makes you tick. Tell me about your when you started knife making. What got you into knife making?
It was, I think, YouTube, really. So I've always been making stuff, you know. As I say, I've making stuff digitally. You know, I've been a web developer for most of my life, but just feeling that need to make physical stuff. So
right.
I was doing this project called Craig Makes, where I'd make a new thing each day, a new physical thing. Didn't really know much about woodworking or metalworking at all. That was maybe a couple of years ago, and just really got into it from that, and just finding these great resources out there, such as YouTube, where there's somebody out there who can tell you how to make anything.
Who are the knife makers on YouTube that you like to watch?
Yeah, well, weirdly, it's Instagram really for knife makers for me. So on YouTube, there's the general makers, you know, Jimmy DiResta and, you know, Alex Steele,
right.
These guys. So, you know, they're amazing. They're making these amazing things. And that's really what got me into it. And making my first knife was just, wow, this is really cool. And I've always had that sort of fascination with knives.
Tell me about your first knife.
My first knife was from my grandfather. So he always had this chest of drawers at the top of his stairs in his house. And I remember, you know, as a young kid, I always remember these drawers. And in the bottom drawer were the knives. Probably not the safest place to keep knives with kids around, but hey.
Well, at least with you around. Okay.
But he had these collection of old pocket knives, pen knives.
Right.
And he gave me this, it was maybe 2-3 inches with an old ivory handle. And I loved it. I was maybe 8 or 9 at the time, so it was my first knife. And I loved it. And I just found that his knives just seemed so sort of precious to me. You know, he looked after them in such a way that they were like jewelry almost. Whereas my grandmother would keep her jewelry in special places, he'd keep his knives in with just the same care. So when I made my first knife, that sort of, I thought, wow, this is something that I can use, and it's got this function to it where I can actually use it every day, and I loved it. So then, you know, you make your next knife and you think, wow, that first knife was crap. Then you make your next knife.
Wow, that's the best.
Exactly. And the last knife you've made is always crap. And I just love that it's a journey. I'm never going to make
that's the best. You hit the nail on the head, Craig.
Yeah.
That's the best part. It's knowing. And this is, you know, as an artist, I have a friend who was an artist, and one of the things what he did was he refused to sell his work, and he was very nervous about selling his work. And I always try to get to the bottom of why that is. And I realized later in life it was because it was a fear that if he ever got rid of that piece of art, he'd never be able to replicate it. Like it was almost like this feeling of like, well, I can't do better than that, where that's like this almost like this idea of, I don't want to say cowardice, but I mean, it's like a fear that you can't do it again. And the best thing you can do as an artist or a maker or a knife maker or a sculptor, whatever, is to say, well, I know the next one's going to get better, so I don't really care about this last one. So there's and I might be totally wrong, but I believe Picasso said, kill your babies. But the idea was, once you finish the piece that you're working on, get rid of it, and the next one's going to be better. And that's a mindset that helps you as a maker or a knife maker or a sculptor say, yeah, that was a great experience. I learned a lot from it. I learned what I'm going to do better next time. And I don't care what happened, you know, give this one away or sell this one, or don't get too caught up with it and get on to that next one. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the sheer utility of a knife as well. You know, I've got some really, really ugly knives in my kitchen, you know, some that I've made, some that others have made, but they work fantastically well. So I know where some people, you know, they have these show knives that they don't really use, but they look incredible. I prefer the utility of a knife to its beauty. That doesn't mean to say it can't be both, but it is.
Well, that's a fine line.
Utility. Yes, exactly.
It's also a fine line when you're a knife maker selling your work. The idea there's you know, I saw Mariko Momassi's knife, and the thing was unbelievable. And I have actually taken class with Nick Anger depending on where you are. And his knives are exquisite. And Aaron Wilburn, his knives are shockingly amazing. They're beautiful. I would be too afraid to use any of them. And it got to the point where I really felt like one time a guy came to my shop and he had ordered a knife, and he came with this glass box with like a velvet pillow. And I said, "What's that for?" And he goes, "Well, when I deliver the knife, I want to put it in this." And I said, "Well, number one, it looks like a coffin. And number two is you got to get rid of this, because if they think this is precious, they're never going to use it."
Yeah.
And I really feel like, especially with chef's knives, you know, I price my knives. I try to do everything to make them. I want you to kick this knife's ass. I want you to use this knife. I want you to, and I always say when I send the knife in the mail or I send an email to someone, I want you to use it in good health and just, you know, use it like it's meant to be used. Otherwise, it's like, you know, if it's an investment and you have a Bob, you know, a $30,000 Bob Kramer knife, okay, I got you. Don't touch it. Don't even breathe on it. Don't even go to the same room that it's in. But if you want a knife that you're going to use every day and then feed your family with and use and just use with the good memories and good feelings, you know, that's important too.
Yes, definitely. Definitely.
I'm sorry for interrupting. One last thing.
No, sure.
You were talking about on the YouTube video guys.
Yes.
You watch Alex Steele and Jimmy DiResta. What knife guys do you like?
Not really any on YouTube that I've really come across.
I tell you what, I'm glad that you said that, because when I first started doing knives, the first knives I made were with Matt Paul of MP Knives. And I started going on, there are two guys who just helped me tremendously. One is Trolsky Knives. He makes these incredible videos of how to make knives and how he goes through his knives. And Aaron Goff, you have got to do whatever it takes to get on this podcast.
Aaron's videos, actually. Yes.
His videos are incredible. And it's like, he can teach someone who doesn't have hardly anything. Well, both of them, Trolsky and Aaron Goff, both show you how to make a knife with you don't need a grinder, you don't need a heat treating oven, you don't need belt sanders, with minimal tools, how you can make a knife. And the things that I learned just watching both of their videos, I was on like this total loop of the two of them. But I mean, Aaron Goff is like, especially.
Yes.
He's a mental patient when it comes to his knives. His knives are like pristine, and he does the same one, and it's just incredible every single one. And he's upgrading everything, but his instructional videos are incredible.
Saw a video where he did a shop tour, and it was like a hospital wing. It was so clean. It was unbelievable.
Well, the best guys, I mean, that's the case. I mean, your perfect example is Nick Wheeler. He's another guy. Nick Wheeler on Instagram, he's Nick Wheeler and the Noofs. And he's probably one of the great. I mean, his knives are incredible. But with the videos that he does is he does incredible tips on. I'll never make knives as nice as Nick Wheeler. I'm fine with that. I'll live with that. That's fine by me. His knives are like pristine, and he does these tips. And the funny thing about his tips, his little videos are awesome. His tips are great. And he always has this incredible soundtrack. It's like this kind of smooth jazz in the background. And he just does these tips with this kind of slick music. He's outstanding, a great resource. Nick Wheeler. Unbelievable.
Correct.
Nick
Wheeler News. I've just made a note of all these, so I'll be checking all these out later.
Oh, I have a whole list. I got a list for you. I have a total list for you.
Fantastic. Send them over.
Well, the other thing is like, I mean, you know, the interesting thing is the whole bladesmith and blacksmith group. There's a connection there. You know, there's a huge connection. You know, blacksmiths were the guys who were making railings. They were making utensils. They were making things for your home. And then it kind of splintered off into the bladesmiths. And if you want to get really, you know, learn about forging in general, I mean, I could list off a million of them, but the Center for Metal Arts is a place in New York, and it's run by Pat Quinn. And he also has a great Instagram, and he does tight forging hammers. There's a lot of hammers. Jake Farum, he's another guy who makes incredible hammers. There's a real resurgence in tool making. It's just Instagram has become this real beautiful place. You get guys who just post pictures of, like me, because my Instagram actually, Fader Knives, is linked to my website. So if I can take do a nice picture of a knife, then it goes to my website. Yeah. And then Jeff Fader does the sculpture. But there's just incredible, especially United States. But one of the unsung heroes in the world, I don't know if it's unsung, I'm just saying it, Australians. The knife makers in Australia are out of control.
Really?
It's unbelievable. Yeah. It's all Bowie knives. And on my mistake, there's a lot of incredible chef's knives. The knife makers in Australia are setting a very, very high tone. It's unbelievable. I love it.
Yeah, yeah. And they've got access to some amazing woods over there for their scales, too. I mean,
big time.
Lots of ironwoods, that kind of stuff. Lovely.
Big time. I've heard for the first time yesterday, I heard of the word beefwood. I never heard of – I didn't even know there was such a thing as beefwood. Mm. You learn something new every day. Beefwood. How dare you? Unbelievable.
Yeah. So what are you finding challenging? Anything that you'd love to make, but you haven't quite built up to it yet?
It's cool. I'm really trying to get to the point where I'm doing more. I want to get to the point where I'm doing less stock removal knives and more forged knives. And the forged knives I really want to do more of is I want to do more integral knives. I love, I was formally trained as a blacksmith. Forging steel is, I understand the mechanics of it. It's, you know, all the mechanics of it, did it for such a long time. And now I want to kind of get back into, now that I did so much in stock removal and kind of clean stuff, I want to get back into integral knives. Integral knives, you're starting out with a thick piece of, a square bar, and then you're kind of, you're forging it down, and then you're kind of, I'm having a hard time with getting that heel 90 degrees to the bolster. Here's another one to write down, Nick Rossi. Nick Rossi teaches at the New England School of Metalwork, and he actually posted pictures of the progression of forging integral chef knives. So you'll see a four-stage progression, and it's like exquisite. I mean, he makes it look easy. All these guys, they make it look easy. Nick Anger, all these guys, they make it look easy. But that's, for me, it's that and working with Damascus. That's the hardest part for me, but I want to do more of it.
Yeah, I think for me, it's just trying to make a good serrated knife. I've tried two or three times, never really given it that much time. But
how do you do it?
Hand files. So yeah, you grind your blade as normal, so a complete flat grind, and then just using hand files to make your. I've tried it with spikes. I've tried it rounded serrations. I've tried it with everything. Just can never get them good.
I will. The first time I had to do it, I had to do the set of knives for a guy, and he wanted a bread knife, and I'd never made one before.
Yeah.
So what I did was I made my template. I made the blade length longer, like the heel longer when I drew it all out.
Yeah.
And then where the blade was, I marked out every quarter of an inch, right?
Yeah.
And then I made a center punch mark every quarter of an inch. And then I drilled every center punch. So then when I cut the line, before I cut the line, I used a steel countersink to kind of countersink it. So you made the scallops.
Right. Gotcha.
And then
yes.
It set the tone. It set the tone for where all the, you know, I spent the time center marking. Every quarter of an inch, because then I use an eighth inch drill bit to hit every center point. And then I could spend the time focusing on the placement of the center punch holes. And then once all the holes were drilled and all the countersinks were kind of, I bumped it so the countersinks would touch each other, you know, the one next to each other would counter each other. And then all you're doing is you're running across the bandsaw, and then you already set the tone for your, for where the, and then you have a very, you have a very, it's, a, it was a great way. And then I ground it down. And
that's
then
a great
I touched
tip.
Everything up with a, then I touched everything up with a chainsaw file, and it turned out great.
Great tip. Yeah.
The problem that people do, the problem that with a lot of chefs, one of the knives that a lot of chefs like, they're usually not expensive, they're called offset serrated knives. And it's great in a professional kitchen because for slicing, for cutting, for doing something quick, they're great and they're thin and they're usually light. But if you look at the blade isn't like teeth of a shark. It's like, it's more like scallops.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that actually is better for the scallops are better for slicing stuff as opposed to bread knife, which is more, which is, I guess, I don't know, I might be completely wrong, but it's better, easier for, I ended up having to really file down. You don't want it too toothy, otherwise it tears your bread and, you know, breadcrumbs.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I recently set up a new workshop in France. We've just bought a house over in France. And
wow. Where in France?
Well, it's the Dordogne, but it's sort of right in the middle of France. The furthest away from a beach you could possibly be.
Wow.
But the bread there is fantastic.
So
I need to make good bread knives. That's what I need to do. So That's a great tip. That's a really good tip. Thank you very much.
We were in Paris over the summer. My wife and I spent, we saved up and we went to England where I dropped a knife off for a friend of mine in Winchester. And then we took my daughter to Paris. So that was like a bucket list trip that now my daughter is, she wants to be a chef and she likes the fact that I deal with a lot of chefs all the time. So she wants their, Paris is, France is just an incredible place, but you must be not too far from, Lyon.
No, we're a fair distance. So where,
oh, really?
Where I'm based in the UK, which is in Wales, which is quite in England, right. I'm actually closer to Paris here than I am when I'm at the house in France.
Huh.
which baffles me. But
what's the Eurostar? We took the Eurostar. We did the Eurostar from, and that was a pretty quick trip.
Yes, yeah.
From London to Paris.
Yeah, I mean, I can fly there, so it's from the local airport, so it isn't too bad, but... But yeah, so bread knife, that's going to help me a hell of a lot.
Well, I just had out of curiosity, one of my favorite knives of all time, and it's something that I've always really wanted to do, is I really want to do folding knives. And I've fooled around with a couple, and they didn't come out the way I wanted them to. And the mechanism is not a big deal, but it's just like, I'm not willing to say, okay, I'm going to make these and try to sell them. My favorite knife of all time is one of them is a Lyol. Lyol is this classic French. Maybe a more like a Basque style knife. They're usually like in the United States, they're like waiter's knives, and they have file work on the back. There's usually a B at the front of the knife, and the knife has on the slip joint part. There's a lot of file work, and it's one of the most famous knife companies. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong, in France, they're so classic that those guys they make just incredible pocket knives.
They do. And even the local sort of news agents, the local shops, that they all have knife displays where they sell knives. Yeah. It's incredible.
Well, it also is, I mean, I don't like to do a plug for Lyol, but online you can actually customize the knife. I really like the fact that you can basically customize the knife you want, and then a couple of weeks later they'll make that, you'll get something in the mail from France, and it's this kind of cool little pocket knife.
Yeah, I mean, and again, other French like Opinel, that kind of stuff, I love for the sheer utility of them. They're cheap, but they hold an edge. They're great little knives.
I wondered if they actually even heat treated those Opinel knives. I get so many bends in them, and I just wonder, I'm like, what is going on? No, that's why they're $15 a knife.
Exactly. The tips keep coming off for me, but that's, when you need a screwdriver, you just pick one up quickly and it break a tip.
Tell me, Craig, when you look at chef knives, what kind of chef knives do you like?
Well, this is something I've been toying with a lot over the last maybe month or two. So, when I first started, I was making almost sort of Santoku kind of, Japanese sort of inspired things.
Right.
But maybe spending time in France, I don't know. But more of a traditional Western knife is what I've been making over the past 4 or 5 weeks.
Right.
And just loving the sheer beauty of that. So, I think I'm going into a more sort of traditional sort of style, maybe.
When I started doing, I wanted to do my version of a Japanese style knife, and I wanted to do a full tang Gyoto or those Japanese kind of like Santoku style.
Yeah.
And because one of the things about my knives is that I do a lot of file work. And I like doing the file work. I think it's a really beautiful addition. I think that it's not so difficult. That I think that, you know, you're throwing a little bit of extra on the knife. I think it's just a nice little bit of flair, especially for, you know, you just not something you normally see on chef's knives in general.
Yeah.
I usually do about 3 inches of it. So I wanted to include that. And you know, they change. One thing I will say is about, I started doing the WA style handles. The WA style handles are the Japanese style, like for the Japanese sushi knives and stuff like that. Basically, you're making a hidden tang knife, and then you're kind of slipping it into the wooden handle.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
A lot of
and,
times
and do you burn
find,
them on, or do you drill a hole?
I don't know. You know what? I learned from I learned another guy to look at is Dahlman. Dahlman knives. He's in Sweden. He makes really awesome WA style handles. His WA style handles are great. I've been fooling around. What I do is I drill out. I make my stick, my hidden tang, about 3/8 of an inch, and then I'll drill through my wood the 3/8 inch hole, and then I'll take some wood sometimes, and I'll take a 3/8 dowel, and I'll cut it a little bit, and I'll make it so it can slide in, and then I'll make the top part of the bolster. I'll kind of drill out and then file it so the knife fits in exactly, and yeah. You know, it's a very clean, it's a fussy handle, but it becomes very clean.
Yes.
And then recently I've been trying to fool around with, I learned from, Mariko Mumasi and, Nick Wheelers. They do this, what they do is they'll put a little bit of beeswax on their stick tang, and then they'll fill the hole up of their handle. I don't know, this isn't going to come through very easy, but if they fill the hole up of the handle with epoxy, and then they put the beeswax onto the knife, and then you drop it in, and then you get it straight. And when it dries, you heat it up, the knife will just up a little bit so it melts the beeswax, and then you can pull out your knife blade, and then you have the exact fitting of where your knife needs to be.
Very nice.
I tried that with an integral knife, and that was a really slow. I want to fool around with that some more.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
really kind of a neat way to go.
Nice. Interesting way of doing things, that.
There's a million different ways. There's a million different ways, and there's no right way, and you have to do what works for you.
Yeah.
Know?
Oh, completely, completely. So I'm very conscious that I've I've kept you on the line for a long time.
No, I have another question for you.
Sure, go for it. Go for it.
How do you heat treat your knives?
I've got a small Devil Forge. Which I think came from the States, actually. So it's just this double burners, two burners. It'll take maybe a sort of 12-inch blade at most.
Right.
Wouldn't want to put anything bigger in it, really.
And then you just go to try to get to 1500 non-magnetic, and then you quench?
Exactly, yeah. So I'm mainly using sort of D2 or maybe even O1 at times. And it's straight into the oil. And then I just use a domestic, you know, home oven for tempering afterwards.
Yeah. Wow. That's, you know, I when I first started, I was doing so much, and I know you want to get me off the line, but,
oh no, not so
real, real quick is I, when I was in the beginning, I was using a forge. I had a forge that I built with John Ledford, actually bitted my, this blacksmith built this forge for me. And, I was doing heat treating that way, non-magnetic, 1500 non-magnetic, and then dumping it. And then when I started doing a lot of stainless steel, all of a sudden that goes out the window, because you really have to really be. So I would send my knives to my friend Kyle Daly, who would heat treat them for me.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where I was like, I just got to get a heat treating oven. And having a heat treating oven, the two most important pieces of equipment I have really are the heat treating oven for making knives for me is the heat treating oven, and then the 2x72 inch grinder.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So do you have an even heat, I assume?
I have an even heat. Those guys make great ovens.
They do. They do. And the shipping is just as much as the actual oven to get one over here.
Well, for you, I'm sure. I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
I had to be home for when the shipping came on my thing.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, I can't really find a decent European supplier. And you know, there's lots of people, you know, doing homemade versions, that kind of thing. And I think maybe that's a route I'll go down. It's got to that point.
Well, you know, There's a knife maker and a machinist in California. His name is Tucker Paris. It's Tap Forge.
Oh, yes. And I follow them. Yes. Yeah.
Tucker's a great guy, and he's a super smart guy. He's like a real brain. He's like a machinist for I don't remember what college, university he's at, but he set up a temperature thermometer in his forge.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was very difficult. And that's really what it comes down to, is being able to have control over your heat. And if you maybe there's something there, maybe Tucker can help you out with kind of monitoring your forge.
I do use a laser thermometer kind of thing, but it doesn't really help with sort of, you know, getting, you know, a good ramp of heat, or right. you know, for soaking things at a, you know, at right. a set temperature.
Yeah.
There's a lot of
yeah.
moving in and out, but that does help in a way. But yeah, I think I'm at that stage where I need something, you know, to control the temperature a bit more.
Well, maybe you need to get it. You know, maybe, and I know that you have a deal with going on with Tormek, who I have a Tormek, which I love.
There we go.
Tormek, this Tormek machine, I was so excited to get it. And I'm looking forward to talking to Tormek guys when I go to the Blade Show.
Cool.
You need to get a sponsorship from Even Heat. Even Heat's got to hook you up. Those guys are awesome.
They
Those
do.
Guys are super
they
nice
definitely
on
do.
Instagram. Come on, Even Heat. Come on, got to help Craig Lockwood out. I mean, we're giving you a good plug here. Even Heat, it's Even Heat. Here's Even Heat Kilns, or go fuck yourself. It's over. That's it.
Brilliant. You do my job for me. That's great.
That's it.
But actually, talking about Tormek, do you have the T4 or the T8?
I have the T8. But I'm kind of going back and forth with I like it very much, and I've used it different ways, and I have to figure out better ways in which to use the jigs. I'm having a hard time personally, and it's totally operator error in terms of using the jigs without scratching my knives up. I'm covering them up and stuff like that. But I'm shocked at how good it works. And it's just I started out just kind of resharpening some of my knives. It's just an awesome, awesome machine. I love the Tormek. I'm psyched to have it.
Well,
and I just signed up to be in the running for the next one. So,
oh yeah. So any listeners who would like a Tormek,
oh yeah,
they can get onto knifetalk.net and simply give us the email address. And we don't use it for anything that we shouldn't be using it for. It's literally for a competition. So on our 10th episode, we'll have a winner, and they'll get a T4 in the post. We've got the full jig set, so you can sharpen axes, chisels, the rest of it.
It's great, and they come with like a little jig to kind of resurface your wheel, and it has two grit stone to kind of make you go from coarse to smooth. It's a tight machine, man, and you can't stop. I tried to stop it. I couldn't stop it. It is awesome.
So here's a question for you.
Shoot.
The one piece of kit in your workshop that you couldn't live without.
Oh, you're killing me. It depends. You're killing me. I'm having a power hammer built. When the power hammer comes, the power hammer is going to be the one piece of equipment. I don't know. You know, I have hammers that I love. I have a hammer I made for my friend Sunset Forge made me. I have a hammer from Jake Farum. I have a hammer from Uri Hoffi. I love my hammers. I have a Beaumont KMG that is just a monster. It is just a monster. I love that. Love the Even Heat. I'm trying to think about the one thing. I tell you what I love that I haven't even used yet. I just bought a anvil from Jesse Savage. It's a 1908 Hay Button from Brooklyn. This thing is like the type that Wile E. Coyote dropped on, you know, the Roadrunner. This is real classic style Looney Tunes anvil.
Yeah.
I can't, Craig, I'm at a loss. I don't know what to tell you. If the shop's on fire and I got to run in there, I might die in there with the fire. I don't know what I'd grab first.
That's a good answer. Very good answer. So, but I'm going to wrap
up. Trouble.
I am going to wrap up with a final question.
Yes, sir.
So
Well, then I'm going to ask you a question too.
Sure.
We're switching it up. You ask your question, and I'll think of mine.
Cool. So we've talked about, I mean, you've given me a huge list of resources to go to after the show. People I need to be following, things I need to see. And there's lots of resources out there for knife makers, bladesmiths, you know, whatever you may want to call yourself. Forums, YouTube channels, Instagram. But where do you find your inspiration outside of the traditional methods?
That's an awesome question. I find a lot of my inspiration isn't necessarily from knife makers.
Yeah.
I really like I get a lot of inspiration from sculptors. I get a lot of inspiration from artists. Growing up in New York City, I grew up with the artist Keith Haring. And what Keith Haring did for me was he did these kind of cartoony drawings, and it was crack as whack. And he hung out with Madonna and Fab Five Freddy. And he was like a huge part of the art community in New York City in the 80s. And what he did was he really made art for the people.
Yeah.
And he made it very accessible. And that was something that was really important to me, because I really felt as an artist that art isn't just about being in a gallery and only certain people can have it. And my old boss, Lee Tribe, was a sculptor. He was made small steel sculpture. And he said, it's important that art be approachable to a buyer. And that was really inspiring to me as a knife maker, because I really want my knives to be approachable. I want people to have them and use them. Who would be my inspiration? I've named them all on this throughout this podcast. you're killing me. Some chefs. Charlie Palmer is a huge inspiration. It's seeing what people are doing. It's seeing what people are doing and just kind of, it doesn't have to be a knife maker. You know what?
Yeah.
People are kind of, that creative process is just so inspiring. And it's like yesterday, I got so inspired by Mariko Mamasi's knife. I got depressed and then I got inspired. I got depressed and then I wanted to go out and I wanted to kick some ass. You know, I wanted to make something, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's always wanting more and always wanting to see what other guys are doing and just trying to make your stuff better and just, you know, being excited for the future.
Cool. Good answer.
All right. Who's your inspiration, Craig Lockwood?
Oof. I think I'm going to just rip you right off here and say almost the same thing. It's just seeing people's enthusiasm for things as opposed to a person. And again, chefs, you know, it's the reason I got into making chef knives specifically. It's because I love food and I wanted to make something I could use myself. And, you know, I'm not talking, you know, high end chefs here. I'm talking about people who, I mean, Jamie Oliver, for example, you know, as a young boy, he got me cooking when, you know, particularly here in the UK, we didn't have cool chefs on the TV.
Right.
You know, it was the mum's job to do the cooking.
Right.
And he made it cool for anybody to go out and learn to cook. And, you know, he's not doing the most fancy food, but he's just getting more and more people cooking. And you know, his passion for what he does, that's what gets me going, you know. And it can be anybody doing anything. It doesn't have to be a chef. It doesn't have to be a knife maker. It could be, you know, a bike
builder.
That's
the best.
It's all about passion. That's what sort of gets me going.
Outstanding.
Great.
Outstanding. Stuff. Craig, it was a pleasure to be on your podcast.
Great.
We should do it again sometime.
We certainly should. It was great fun. So thank you.
Anytime. I'm with you.
And if you could send over an email with a list of those people I need to follow, because
I will give you a list and it's gonna choke your computer. I had to write, actually, before we met, I had to write everything down because I was like, I have got to mention all these people because, you know, here's another thing is Jesse Savage and Rick Barter have an awesome podcast. It's called The Blacksmith's Pub.
Yes.
And Jesse's the guy who told me you got to watch Knife Talk.
Oh, really?
He got me. Jesse said, I was on his podcast, The Blacksmith's Pub, which is on the Burn Network, which you should be involved with, just between you and me and everybody listening. And Jesse was the one to say to me, you got to watch this. You got to watch. We both listened to it. And I was like, this is unbelievable. This is like, because when I do podcasts, it's like Dick jokes and intermits with other things. And talking to you is like, I feel like I'm on the BBC. It's unbelievable.
Well, maybe not quite. But yeah, I discovered Jesse's podcast just this week and I had a long train journey. So I listened to a few episodes and it's great. It's fantastic. Learned so much. So thank you, Jesse, for listening. Thank you.
Oh, Jesse. And my guy.
Well, I think that's a good time to wrap up.
Yes,
but,
sir.
But again, thank you so much, Jeff. Where can people find you online?
Well, there's Feder Knives, FederKnives, on Instagram and obviously website, and Feder Knives on Facebook. And then I do, that's really the knives that I put on my website and the finished stuff. But for fooling around stuff, in progress stuff, sculpture, I have Jeff Feder with a G, Jeff Feder. Yep. GeoffFeder on Instagram. And I do a lot of, there's a lot of sculpture stuff and, you know, there's knives through there too.
Great stuff. And I'll make sure I put all your recommendations up in the show notes as well. So people can find those guys and we should be good to go.
I just like to say one last thing.
Sure.
What you're doing, Craig, is really important. And this is something that I didn't think 15 years ago when I was dealing with these kind of blacksmiths who were very, they were not passing on information. I felt like before Instagram, I felt like, well, this is the reason why blacksmithing isn't being passed on or bladesmithing in general, because there wasn't this kind of generosity and information given. And what you're doing with this podcast is so important for people who, you know, if you want to start out or you're at the highest level, you're about to do your master smith test, or you just want to do your own knife. What you're offering is very, very important. And I'm very appreciative of what you're doing. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Speak to you soon, Jeff.
All right, my man.